Recovering Queen, the Queen fan podcast, where we talk about and play the songs we love with Jay, Matt, and Ian.
Welcome to the Recovering Queen podcast, the podcast in which we three Queen fans take a Queen song, a famous one or not so famous one, do a cover version of it, and then talk about what we've learned about the methods of the madness of the greatest band that there has ever been, Queen. My name's Ian, and with me are Matt and Jay.
Right, so what song are we doing this week, Jay?
You and I.
You and I.
The classic.
Absolute. Yeah. It's a beautiful little song, isn't it? Off Day at the Races. Now, bear in mind, this is the song that John writes after writing the hit single, You're My Best Friend, which presumably took the band a bit by surprise by its utter quality of a song. And You and I is the follow-up, really, isn't it, to You're My Best Friend.
Mm.
Now, it's hard to argue, isn't it, that it's on a par with...
But that seems very unfair start because it's such a good song.
It's an unfair start, but I reckon the rest of this podcast we're going to be saying how good it is.
Yeah.
But it's worth tempering it with the fact that this is the song that John does. But that's a bit like Day at the Races as a whole, isn't it, really?
Yes.
Day at the Races, no matter how great an album it is, and it is great, it's not as good as Night at the Opera.
I prefer it to Night at the Opera as an album. It always impresses me more whenever I... Maybe it's over-familiarity for Night at the Opera, but I prefer the songs on Day at the Races, and it's got somebody to love on it.
Well, I mean, that's interesting because there was a good quote of Freddie talking about Somebody to Love against Bohemian Rhapsody, in which... He was saying, well, for him, it's a far better song. He's much happier with it. The progression and the skill in songwriting for him was a big advancement on Bohemian Rhapsody. So I guess they're seeing things in their own way. And to be honest, I might like it a bit more than Bohemian Rhapsody.
Oh, Somebody to Love is the pinnacle of Queen's skill. Mm. That and a handful of other songs, Somebody to Love really is. It really is. Unbelievable.
Unbelievably well constructed.
I think in that context, though, I think that actually puts You and I maybe down another peg in the fact that John's not quite got up to the height that he did on You're My Best Friend, I don't think. And I'm not quite sure why, because maybe the song itself is as good, but I think maybe the instrumentation is so genius on You're My Best Friend, isn't it?
Well, I think, again, it's probably the opposite to Bohemian Rhapsody versus Somebody to Love. You're My Best Friend is completely consistent within itself. It's completely congruent from start to finish. Whereas And You and I, for a relatively short song, is surprisingly complex.
It's bonkers. See, I'm not a massive fan of the verses, but the sort of two bridge parts... Because it doesn't really have a chorus, does it? It's got bridges rather than choruses.
It's almost like a one-line chorus, isn't it?
Yeah.
And You and I.
And You and I,
It almost doesn't need it, though, when the melody is so strong all the way through it.
The melody's strong, but the bridges take it into completely new territory, don't they?
And actually... It's very much a big gear change, isn't it, into those bits. I mean, it works, but it's not as elegant songwriting as... kind of John's done before and since, really.
No, it's more experimental. In fact, there's a certain jazziness to one of the bridges, the sort of chromatic bass part that you don't normally get.
I think the thing I love about it is that Freddie just sounds so happy when he's singing it. And I think he is, when he sings John Deacon songs, you can just feel that he's absolutely loving it.
Yeah, it really comes across, doesn't it? The sense of joy singing it. Yeah.
When I was doing my paper round, I used to have a little cassette Walkman, and I made myself a compilation of John Deacon tracks. just John Deacon tracks as a kind of mixtape. And that is the thing that comes across, is Freddie Mercury's vocal on John Deacon songs are incredible, like always incredible performances.
Yeah.
He clearly enjoys singing John Deacon songs.
Yeah. Well, we've said it before, I think, haven't we, that I think it was Freddie that very much encouraged him as a songwriter.
They're in tune, aren't they, together?
Yeah, very much so.
Now, on the album liner notes, it says that John Deacon plays the acoustic guitar. And the acoustic guitar is a little bit buried in this song, but it is pretty good. It's actually harder than I thought it was going to be to play, because I've done a fairly to the letter cover of it.
With the acoustic guitar, then you must have not transposed, I'm guessing, then.
No, so I didn't transpose this one, which is still a problem for the vocal. At the moment, I don't know whether I'm going to have to hand in a vocal with a slightly changed melody for the verses.
If I remember, isn't it like it's all D, A's and B minors, isn't it? So it's quite guitar friendly.
I mean, it's in D major, which is always a plus for guitar, isn't it? And but there's quite a few chords in there. And
there is.
Freddie does that really beautiful thing on piano where he arpeggiates that one, which for me is that key change of the bridge where he changes that part and does that piano bit. But there's an interesting thing that Freddie said for an interview for Circus magazine when this album came out. And he said, "You and I is a John Deacon track. It's very John Deacon with more raucous guitars. After I'd done the vocals, John put all these guitars in and the mood has changed." So that for me suggests that John Deacon is playing those sort of Eastern vibe bits of electric guitar, doesn't it? Because those bits that the do-do-do-do-do-do-do are the ones that really change the vibe of the song.
Yeah.
So I wonder if John actually played those bits, which even like ages ago, I remember thinking they were quite odd as Brian May parts. And when Brian May actually plays his solo, God, it is an absolute, he couldn't be more Brian May if he tried.
Oh,
on that
no,
solo.
No, it's a glorious solo, isn't it?
It's absolutely.
I mean, obviously, you know, John and Roger got form by playing their own guitar parts on their own tracks before. So, you know, entirely plausible.
So, yeah, I think John Deacon spent a bit of time altering the feel of the song. It'd be interesting to have heard what the original sounded like when it's just Freddie singing vocals and piano.
Right. Mm. It'd be interesting. I don't know. It'd be lovely to get hold of the stems, wouldn't it? And isolate them and try and work out, is it John playing them? Mm. I'm sure you could tell if you could hear them isolated.
Mm. There's nice bits of toms in there as well, which I notice and appreciate in the intro. And
well, I was going to say that because I was listening to it earlier and the drum sounds, obviously, they sound absolutely brilliant. Yeah. But I always almost think they're a little bit too aggressive and they're too massive for such a little pop song. You know, you've got that bit right at the very end where he's got the high rotor. And it's like, bang, bang, da, dang, dang, dang. Whoa, Rog.
Well, it's always your joke that I used to really enjoy with your, the inappropriateness of the EastEnders fill-in. La 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 la.
I found them a little bit like that. I mean, but then I suppose if you've got the drums sounding like that, you probably want to push them up in the mix as well, don't you? It just sounded, you know, they kind of got the wrong guy in to do those fill-ins for that one bit.
Oh no, I have to say I love that bit where John Deacon's playing up the neck of the bass and Roger's doing those I mean, the drum sounds are wicked. Yes. I absolutely love the drum sounds on that. That was the first one where he's brought in his timbali as part of his fill-ins, isn't it?
Is it? Yeah. Rototoms, I think. But
Are they rototoms? Yeah. I've used timbales in my because I've got that sort of similar kind of.
Well, very difficult to get. There's no Roger Taylor drum sample set, is there? Well, not from that era, anyway.
No.
I think Spitfire Audio did some playing his modern setup down at Hadley Grange. I think recently.
Yeah, that's on his. DW kit though, isn't it? Rather than his Ludwig kit of the period.
Yeah, but his kit's changed since then, and I don't think he's got the rototoms anymore. Which
no, Taylor Hawkins completely has though, hasn't he? I saw that interview on Radio 1 where he's set his kit up exactly like Roger Taylor. He couldn't be a bigger Roger Taylor fan if he tried.
No, absolutely.
He sort of looks like him and sings like him.
Matt, did you have a lot of fun recording that? Because obviously it is a very big, happy track. Was that the same for you?
Yeah, no, definitely. The bit that I really liked was learning the piano part. I actually thought it was going to take me ages, and the piano part was reasonably simple. I think I broke it up into a couple of sections because I struggled to record the whole thing like with no mistakes with that arpeggio bit in the middle. I mean, it's not that hard, but I didn't have the time to kind of perfect it. So it's me on my upright acoustic piano. So it's a little bit honky. It's slightly more honky.
Well, I was going to say, because it was slightly Beatles-esque in places.
Yeah, it's more Oh Bloody Oh Brother, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's got
a little bit
kind of feel to it.
But then I really like the bits that went into, and there was another section where it was a little bit more like ELO or something. I think it was the backing vocals coming through that you were doing on those. There was a lot going on in there, and I like that. That was nice.
Yeah, I was playing on an £80 Amazon bass and my free upright piano, which was, was good, isn't it?
Yeah.
But, the bit that I really liked playing was the Brian May's guitar solo, getting my kind of fingers around that. I think that's an amazing guitar solo. And there's another little break.
May, isn't it?
There's another little break just after the guitar solo that's really, really good as well. The harmonies are great. The way that they've done the sort of vocal harmonies. And yeah, I mean, the only bit that's just a real problem is the lead vocal, because it's Freddie Mercury all over the place with an extremely powerful performance. Very, very soulful and very, very poppy. I mean, it's such a happy song. You know, there's no dark side to it. Other than the kind of weird bridge, the second of the bridges, which is that kind of middle eight bit where it gets a little bit more rocky. I mean, I absolutely love that bit, and I always have done that. I think it's just an epic.
Well, it just explodes, doesn't it? It just explodes out of it. And it's.
And we really are in this era. Obviously, it lasted a few years, but Freddie is absolutely at the height of his powers at this stage, isn't he? I mean, his vocal... you know, vocals do not get any better than Freddie's performance on
That's
every
majestic.
Track on this album.
Yeah, and it's a weird era of music, isn't it? This is the point where punk is about to wash over Britain as well. In fact, this is a story that I read today, which isn't necessarily relevant to you and I, but I didn't realise that Freddie was supposed to appear on the Bill Grundy show, but got a dental appointment, so cancelled it. And that was the Bill Grundy show that the Sex Pistols went and did and essentially exploded punk into the that moment. So Freddie almost so Freddie's teeth were responsible for punk in some way.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's totally plausible, isn't it? They were recording in the same studio. At the time, they were on the same label. I think, didn't EMI drop them after that interview because they were too hot to handle on
an old
traditional
Richard Branson
label?
Rushed around and grabbed them.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, this album was recorded at, a lot of it was recorded at Richard Branson's manor house.
I mean, what I find incredible about the whole thing is, you know, there's millions and millions of people out there that love Queen, and they will probably never have heard this track. And you just think, but they might have heard Invisible Man instead.
It's one of those tracks, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, God.
It's one of those huge Queen tracks. To Queen fans and you and I, is just a massive track, isn't it?
I've always partnered it up with Long Away as well. Those two tracks really go well together on the album, and I can't really separate them. In my mind, actually, because I guess... I never really separate the two from each other. And you'll give me that. You'll correct me if I'm wrong here, Ian, but Queen never did You and I Live, did they?
No, sadly not. I guess it would be slightly ambitious. It's a bit stop and start. Freddie would be tied to the piano. Yeah. And as well, the set list at that point was getting pretty congested with massive hits. So again, I think it's what Jay said, what would they drop to put you and I in?
Yeah, it's a great era for Queen. They've also produced this themselves, haven't they? So they haven't completely split away from Roy Thomas Baker. They've just sort of said, we want a break, because they remained on pretty good terms. Guess what Roy Thomas Baker went on to go and produce in his hiatus from Queen? Ian Hunter's Mott the Hoople.
Ah.
Really?
So, so Mott the Hoople is intertwined with Queen's history,
a lot
in the 70s.
Yeah, yeah. So, And You and I, it gets the status of last track on side one, which is, I think that's quite an honour, really, isn't it, for such a poppy track. You'd think you'd get a much higher status song to kind of close out the album, but they finish on a real up.
Yeah. The album almost needs it. It almost needs that kind of breathing space. Long Away and You and I both have that kind of feel of, right, we're just going to calm it down for you a bit because we're going to give you good old-fashioned Loverboy in a bit and that's going to blow your mind. There's not much to talk about the lyrics, is there? There's no hint of Roger Taylor's sex, drug, and rock and roll. There's no hint of Brian May's creepiness, and there's no hint of Freddie's flamboyance, is there? It's just straight romantic John, isn't it?
Yeah. No, there's no dichotomy of Brian's confusing lyrics.
Well, no, I mean, Brian certainly goes there with Tie Your Mother Down, doesn't he?
He certainly does again. He's
of course, in those days, that meant quite something different.
So, talking about the Day at the Races on a slightly wider perspective, should it have been a double album?
Day at the Races and Night at the Opera.
Nah.
Surely songs
much.
Would have
it's
got lost
much.
If it was that big.
I think they stand as the what's really weird is that now when I look back, I think that Day at the Races is very different to Night at the Opera. I think it's a lot more direct. I think it's definitely sort of going in a much more, it's got rid of a lot of the whimsy for a start off. It's just a lot more direct than Night at the Opera.
I think that's why I prefer it. It's because for me, Night at the Opera always surprises me how many whimsical novelty songs are on there. Whereas Day at the Races has got just back-to-back absolute quality songs.
Yeah, well, but there's more singles off Day at the Races than any other album before it. Yeah, I mean, it's got five singles off it or something, Dak.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
It's chock-a-block full of people at the top of their sort of songwriting craft, but not necessarily at the top of their kind of innovation craft, I don't think.
No, and where do we feel that it sits in the John Deacon canon? It's up there, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think it's a pop song and you would choose You're My Best Friend over it, I think. I think it is, you know, in comparison to You're My Best Friend, it doesn't get to that point of this is a great piece of songwriting.
No.
Whereas
it's no spread your wings
or a couple of the other sort of John Deacon tracks that you could say this is great songwriting, but it's better than say 1 Year of Love,
slightly down from his very very best work. But then his very very best work is astonishingly good, so it's no insult really.
But considering how many songs he's written for Queen and how many of them are monstrous hits, that he is like a fine songwriter.
Oh God, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think Ian summed it up with the, it's not quite as elegant as You're My Best Friend. There's like slight superfluous bits maybe, or as you, I think you said, Matt, about the arrangement, but it's a fantastic song, isn't it? And I think we should leave it there.
So here it is. Here is Matt's version of You and I.
Together forever. Just you and I.